Hi, my name is Rain Dog.
Hi, Rain Dog. And you're a poet.
I'm many things, but poetry is one of the things that I am, yes.
How long have you been pursuing this sort of as a I don't want to say as a profession or as a pastime. What would you call it?
I don't know. It's a pain in the ass, really, but yeah. It's a hobby that I'd like to turn into more of a vocation than an avocation, but you know, that likelihood of that is pretty slim. So, but
you've actually published, you've actually created your own publication.
Oh yeah.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, let's see. I've been writing for probably 30 years, but I didn't really start like a good solid run at it till about 93. And in 93, I started submitting work. I think in 94, I started submitting work to magazines, these little poetry magazines. And I wasn't real happy with the treatment I was getting. Mm-hmm. And I'm the kind of guy that says, hey, you know, if you don't treat me right, I'll just do it myself.
Well,
and that's kind of how it started.
Well, how were they treating you?
Oh, you know, they didn't respond well to the whole idea of somebody calling himself Rain Dog, you know. I figure, you know, if you have the right to have a pen name, then people should respect that.
Absolutely.
But they weren't willing to do that. It didn't happen to, I mean, I like to have zero tolerance for that kind of treatment. So, I mean, it happened twice, and I thought, okay, that's fine. I'll do it my way. Thank you very much. You know, I'm just going to create my own world. And that's kind of how it started. It just sort of evolved. You know, I thought I would... I started doing a little magazine, and out of that little magazine came... publishing books and publishing other people's work and doing all this stuff. And now, like 15 years later, I'm just getting around to doing my own thing, or, you know, promoting my own work. So I kind of took a side trip, a little detour there, because I thought, you know, I'll do the magazine. Maybe I'll sell some subscriptions, make some money for stamps, you know, so I can keep submitting my work out to the general, you know, world. And it just kind of got away from me, and next thing I know, it's like 10 years later, and I'm thinking, well, gosh, who's going to promote me? I'm promoting everybody else, so that's nice.
Yeah, we're joined here by two dogs and a cat, so if you hear extraneous noises, it's not Rain Dog or I.
No, I'm being really cool. I'm hardly moving at all.
You're well behaved today. I don't mean to dwell too much on the magazine, but it was called
The Lummox Journal.
The Lummox Journal, and it was the Lummox Press is
right,
the sort of the publication,
right,
entity.
Right.
I just wanted to ask you though that in the process of putting that together, did you discover sort of like a whole group of writers that
were, oh, yeah,
having the same kinds of experiences that you were, as far as
You know, it's funny. I started out doing this magazine. My initial thought was that I was going to interview poets who worked, because they have like all these varying experiences working. The commonality is that they all write. So I thought, well, that might be an interesting subject to pursue. And I also wanted to, you know, be able to publish my own poetry anytime I damn well chose. Except as it works out, I wasn't like that. I didn't do that much. You know, I really didn't abuse the privilege of having a magazine, I don't think. But I interviewed a lot of different, I think I've interviewed about 100 different people over the course of the 11 years that I did the magazine. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember, too, that I did the magazine on a monthly basis.
Which is crazy.
I did that for 8 years. I was doing it on a monthly basis. And I had to plan all my vacations around deadlines and, you know, stuff. And I met a lot of people through the magazine. In fact, I became very good friends with a couple of them. And I can't say that any two people are have like a common experience. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had like a stock set of questions that I would ask people, and I would just let them run with it. And, you know, so sometimes I'd get really concise interviews. Sometimes I'd get rambling interviews. One guy wrote me an sent the interview questions back to me, and it was, he repeated himself a lot, and I realized that I could probably craft part of the answers into an essay, you know, or an article or something. And so that's what I did. And it's funny too, because this guy, he teaches creative writing workshops for a living, and I think he just believes in, like, you know, just kind of stream of consciousness kind of stuff. So his interview was kind of stream of consciousness too. So.
Well, that works sometimes. It just really depends on where your consciousness is.
Yeah, yeah. This is true.
So after doing that for a while, did you find that you were feeling like this, aside from the process of getting yourself published in your own journal, did you feel like the process of doing this process, did it help cement your self in the community of writers? I mean, or in the community of publishers? Or, I mean,
it's kind of weird. I have a rep, but it's like, I don't think I could really capitalize on it, you know? It's like a lot of people know me or know of me, but as far as any kind of like establishing a relationship to the writers that exist in LA or Long Beach, it really hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. But I'm known all over. I can say I'm legitimately known in several countries in Europe and in Australia and in most of the United States, except I can't get any respect in my quote unquote hometown. You know? it's kind of weird because I read a post on a group in Boston. This guy puts out a little list for publishers. And this guy's talking about me on this in this posting, and it says R.D. Armstrong, an icon in the small press. And I'm like, well, if I'm an icon, you know, where's my limousine? Or, you know, it's just weird. It's like I have this reputation for being a respectable editor slash publisher slash poet. But it still doesn't, you know, I mean, I have to put my pants on the same way as everybody else. I mean, it's not like, it's kind of weird. It's like having a reputation, but like locally, it's like, you know, well, I couldn't even get invited to the Long Beach Poetry Festival. I mean, you know,
well,
small press icon. I mean, come on.
I didn't even know about it until you told me about it.
You know, I was looking in the district today to see if they had they didn't even promote it. I mean, there's no mention of it at all.
Well, maybe they just want to stay on the down low, you know, keep it secret.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of reading over the years, and you've done a lot of other. You've participated in events over the years. There's got to have been some. And also, I know that you're quite beloved by many people that I know.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah,
because when I can't work anymore, I'm going to be looking for a place to curl up in the corner. So this is nice. I like it here. As long as the dogs don't bite me, I'll be okay.
Yeah, our dogs generally don't bite. They're noisy, but otherwise they're pretty well behaved. Now, more recently, you put out a collection of your own work.
Yeah,
that was self-published.
Yeah,
and
well, through my press, Lummix Press.
Okay, so how did that come about? I mean, what went into that process?
Well, I don't know. About a year ago, I guess I had this idea that it'd be nice to put out like a sort of collected works of my writing, my poetry, because I've got like, I don't know, about 800 poems.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a lot for, you know, for people that have been writing all their lives, but, you know, I think it's pretty impressive. So I started the project by going in and reading, like, I have my poetry saved on my computer by the year, so I would just start it, pick a year and start. I read all my poems, and then I picked the ones that I thought were good.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of languished for a while. And in December, I guess, I got this wild hair, and I thought, I've got to get this done. So I really put the old nose to the grindstone and came up with a manuscript. And the manuscript was going to be, looked like it was going to run about 400 pages. And I just thought, that's crazy. That's too much. That's, you know, that's a good way to hold a window up, but that's just a lot of stuff to make people read, you know. Yeah. So I split it. I did volume one, volume two. So volume one is out. And it's my first experience with using a print-on-demand service.
Which one did you use?
I used Lulu.
I've heard good things about them.
I've heard good and I've heard bad. Once you figure out how the system works, they do a good job. I mean, this is what the book looks like. You know, it's nice. It's well made. My last publisher couldn't figure out how to cut the books so they would be rectangular. They were always cattywampus. And when I said something to him about that, he said, well, you guess you can just do it yourself then, Mr. Smarty Pants.
And well, I don't think that's an unreasonable expectation.
No, I think it's a totally reasonable expectation. You know, he wouldn't give me an ISBN number, and which I thought was really kind of sucked because I wasn't important enough.
That's very strange.
Yeah, well, he's a strange guy. Well, I mean, he did write by me for a while, and then we kind of parted our ways. And now I'm coming out. My next book will be the book he published, plus two other poems, two other long poems. It'll be a collection of road poems.
So, but explain a little bit the real benefits of the whole on-demand printing thing.
Well, you have the option of buying a block of books if you want. Like, I was going to buy 100 books, but
it's the cat.
It's the cat. It's a lovable cat. But I realized that I didn't have to do that. I could buy one book at a time. I'm buying like 30 at a time to take to readings and whatnot. People can go online and buy them directly from Lulu, or they can buy them directly from me. If they buy them directly from me, they get the option of having them signed, which,
right,
you know, I guess could be worth some money someday. I don't know, but, you know. Mm-hmm. It's nice when you have the book signed by the author.
I love signed books.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a benefit. So, and you know, it doesn't cost anything. With Lulu, all you have to do is send them a file, send them a cover, and then they print the book. And then you buy the book. Like, they charge me a per unit price plus a small percentage based on the cost, what I'm charging for the book itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's like $10, and then I sell the book for $20. So, you know, we basically split the cost.
Right, right.
And it's great if you're, you know, because there's no warehousing. You know, you don't have to worry about having 100 books sitting around in boxes gathering dust. You know, basically you sell the books as you go. That's the big advantage of print on demand.
Right.
There is a problem now because Amazon, being all-seeing and all-knowing and all-powerful, has decided that they won't sell any books that are sold in a print-on-demand format unless they are done by Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own print-on-demand service called mm-hmm. BookSurge. And so basically, if you're trying to sell your stuff through Amazon, which, of course, I guess is the big goal. I don't know. I've never really dealt with Amazon. I don't really, you know, I could take them or leave them.
Well, they're large.
They're large, and they've got, like, a big access and everything like that. So if you've got, like, a bunch of print-on-demand books available and you can no longer sell them through Amazon, then, you know, that could impact your bottom line.
Sure.
You know, I fortunately am not tethered to whether or not my book sells, because right. I have to make my living elsewhere.
Right.
But if I was making my living from selling books, I'd be pissed.
Right. Yeah.
And a lot of people are pissed. There's actually a boycott going on right now.
Yeah, I didn't really know about that. That I mean, because I have
they
a friend
all did
of mine.
They did it all under the table.
That's really.
I just heard about it.
Wow. Wow.
So.
Well. So have you been taking the book on the road and?
I'm going to be taking it next week. I'm going up to Grass Valley to do a reading up there. And ironically, when I planned the reading or when I got the reading, I didn't have. I had another book, a little red book that I was going to take, but I hadn't even thought about doing this book. So it all sort of fell into place. You know, I mean, it's sort of lucky that. I'm going to be up there, and I'm going to take like 25 books with me or something. Hopefully, I'll sell them all, and that'll help pay for the gas because gas is getting ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you were putting the book together, did you have any feelings about? The audience that it was going to be intended for? Did that shape
well,
the process at all?
Not really, no. I mean, I just put the book together. In fact, people have asked me, how did you figure out which way, how to put the poems together, like the arrangement or the layout of the poems, and it was just pretty much random.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I just think that the work is strong enough that it basically all kind of rolls together pretty nicely.
That's great. Did you discover anything about yourself in the process of going back through all these years of work? Did you have any surprises or new insights into?
I didn't ever really have any insights, but I a couple of times I would read something and I'd go, "Wow, I wrote that? That's pretty good. Damn. My stuff now isn't nearly as good as that." But that's crazy, but you know. Couple times, you know, you just come across a poem that you forgot that you wrote, and it's like, wow, who wrote this? What's it doing in my file? You know?
Right.
When I was younger, I used to write poetry on kind of a therapeutic level.
Mm-hmm.
And I used a lot of metaphor and whatnot, and then I went into therapy, and my therapist kind of, like, sort of weaned me off the metaphor, and, because I would speak metaphorically too, you know, I'd use metaphor a lot in my descriptions of things, and mm-hmm. she kind of got me back down to earth and got me thinking, like, you know, just be real straightforward about what you're trying to say. And so my poetry became more straightforward, very very little metaphor, and that's pretty much what this book has in it. It's that pretty much non-metaphorical poetry that's just kind of. I don't know. I don't want to call it street poetry, but it is kind of that way. So.
And so you were saying the next book, Volume 2?
Yeah, that's going to be... I was going to originally release Volume 1 followed by Volume 2, but then I thought... Because I've got four books planned, or three mm-hmm. books planned now. So I thought, well, maybe I'll just release the other books first, and that way Volume 2 will seem more sensible. Because right... You know, Volume 1, Volume 2, that just... You got to build up a little drama, you know. It's like, what's Volume 2 going to be like?
Right, right.
You know? And basically, Volume 2 will pick up where Volume 1 left off. So But, you know, the next book I'm really looking forward to, because I really enjoy writing these road poems. And the last one I wrote, Roadkill, was a real challenge, because I wrote it right after I went... I took a trip up to Washington State in September of 2001. So I was in Port Angeles, Washington, when 9/11 happened.
Oh.
And the sensation of being 1,300 miles from home and knowing that you can't get home like that, it's going to take a while, you know. Just that whole experience of being sort of upended, you know. And... So that The poem is it's pretty good. I think it's really good, but unfortunately not too many people really got to see it because the guy that published it didn't really do it. I mean, I basically sold the first run. And then when I asked him for more quality control, he told me to hit the road, Jack.
Right.
Ironically.
So you haven't lost control or like copyright ownership of whatever of your work in the process of working with other people, right?
No, it's still yours. I mean, your words are your words unless somebody like buys them from you. Mm-hmm. And nobody's ever bought anything from me. I mean,
right.
they sell the books, but you can't. The whole copywriting thing is, to be honest, it's kind of a mystery. I just put the copyright symbol on the page, and it's the poor man's copyright. You know,
right,
it's,
right.
Instead of like registering it with somebody.
Right. So I was going to ask you about 9/11. Did you have any sense of the? I mean, how did that affect you? How did that? I mean, I know a lot of people had different reactions to it, and some people felt really fearful, and some people felt, in a way, sort of affirmed that, you know.
Yeah.
Where were you on that?
Oh, it really messed me up. I was surprised. Mostly, I was concerned about what the government would do. Like, this is an excuse to, you know, take away all kinds of rights and compromise all kinds of freedoms and whatnot, and all the things that I speculated as possibilities in the poem pretty much have come true, which is, you know, unfortunate, but God, I was smart back then.
Well, you know, it really was surprising to me how people responded to the circumstance, and I mean, I think a lot of it was media driven too,
right? You know, where I was up in Port Angeles visiting friends, and life goes on. I mean, it was weird. I mean, we were playing croquet in my friend's daughter's front yard the day after 9/11, and I kept thinking, this is so odd. I mean, this is so weird. We're like teetering on the edge of some really bad shit, and here we are playing croquet and drinking lemonade. And it's just, I was having a really hard time balancing the Norman Rockwell aspect of the, you know, what we were doing and the whole Big Brother aspect that was kind of lurking out there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was weird. And everybody that I knew up there didn't seem to really be particularly fazed by 9/11, which was kind of strange to me. But, you know, I'm not from New York, and I didn't have any ties to New York. And I know all my friends who are New Yorkers, they all really took it badly because, you know, it happened to their city.
Right.
But, of course, then later on, I used to make this really bad joke that I'd say to people, they'd be talking about how great New York was, and I'd say, well, what's New York got that LA doesn't have besides a big hole in the ground? And I was like, oh man, I can't believe you said that. You know, but,
well, we have the La Brea Tar Pits.
Yeah, we have our own hole in the ground. It's true. It's true.
Well, yeah. So did that... Well, that's another thing I wanted to ask you about, and maybe we can do it in the context of this, is that is there like a particular process that you have for writing? I mean, because I know that some people are, you know, they have a time and a place that they
need
to write.
That's what I used to ask people in my interviews. It's like, what's your process for writing? How do you do that? Do you have time in the morning that you write? Because some people like get up. Like one guy got up at like 5 and would be from 5 to 7, he would be at his computer and he would be writing, and somebody else would do it at night. And I never had a time set, you know. I would just like get an idea, sit down and write it out. And it happens really, I mean, it really happens weirdly, you know. Like I'll be watching TV and something will happen and I'll have a feeling, a reaction to the thing that I'm watching and something, and I'll start to get this idea. So I'll just get up and go to my computer and start writing down whatever the idea is. And usually the poem comes out pretty much unedited mm-hmm. and doesn't require editing.
Right.
I don't really edit my poems very much. In the course of writing, of putting the manuscript together for this book, I did actually go in and revise some poems because as I read them, I realized that, you know, a line could change, give a little more power or whatever. And so I would change them a little bit. But I don't, as a rule, I don't do that. And some of the poems that I write are just, you know, garbage, you know.
Well, it's just like anything. I mean, like photographers take lots of pictures in the hope
exactly.
of getting one good one. You
right,
know, it's not necessarily a bad thing to have that sort of vetting process in your creative.
Unless you're a really famous poet like Bukowski and you're dead and the publishing company that bought out your contract is now publishing all the crap that nobody would accept back when because they just need more... more work. It doesn't matter if it's good or not because people are buying it for the name, not the quality.
Right, right.
I'm not bitter.
Now, do you have a particular affinity with Bukowski at all? I mean,
oh, he was like the man. He was the poet I read. I started reading in 1969 when he was writing for the L.A. Free Press. I was still in high school.
And how did that hit you?
I just liked reading him. I thought he was good, you know. And years later, I began to see that not only was he good, but that he was right on for the most part, the stuff that he came up with. I mean, you know, a lot of people I know, a few people I know actually became friends with Bukowski. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the option would have been there, but I was a fan of the poetry and his fiction. He's great. Great short story writer. I don't think people really appreciate how good he is. But I was never enamored to him as a person because all the stories that I'd heard about him, he sounded like a real dickhead. You know, I think he was a real dickhead.
Yeah.
But that's all right. I mean, that's what worked for him. And I mean, there are probably people that say that about me. I don't know. I mean,
no one I've talked to.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, I don't really care. I mean, you know, it used to really bother me that people would get these ideas about me that were totally unrelated to who I was. But then after a while, I realized that you have no control over how people see you. You know, once the words come out of your mouth or once the song comes out of your lips, you know, basically you're screwed. I mean, they're going to take it the way they're going to take it. You have no say. And just be comfortable in your own skin, and that's what I've been working on for the last few years.
Right. Now, you for a while, I don't know if you're still doing it, but for a while you had a band.
I've had a number of bands, and yeah, because see, I write poetry, but I do other things. You know, I'm probably a frustrated painter, and I've written a number of songs over the years, and I like playing music. You know, I like having fun playing music, and it's more accessible than just reading poetry, I think. The lyric, you know, the melody gives it kind of the melody is like the hypodermic needle, and the lyric is like the whatever's inside, you know.
Right, right.
But that's the delivery system, and I like playing blues and that kind of stuff, but I kind of got away from the fun part of it, so I stopped playing. I was playing for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. Recently, and yeah. it wasn't happening. So I stopped, but I miss it, you know. I miss playing.
Yeah, it's a hard nut to crack sometimes because there's all these personalities that you have to sort of wrangle.
Well, yeah, that's the one thing about being in like a one-man band. You don't have to, unless you're a schizophrenic, you really only have to deal with your own personality. But,
right.
Yeah, I found some guys that I was playing with. That was kind of fun. There was three of us, and we'd just like sit in a semicircle and play songs. And, you know, people seemed to enjoy that. But I couldn't play with them, like, all the time. And when I was playing by myself, people just looked at me like, dude, I'm trying to work on my computer. Can you turn it down a little bit? You know, and it's like, yeah, that's not a good feeling, you know. So I stopped doing that for a while. Although I just ran into some people the other day at Vientoliagua down in Long Beach, and they're in this band called Slushbox, and we were talking, and I said I had this new book of poetry that I was pushing, and they were like, "Oh, you have a new book?" I said, yeah. I said, "You know, let me show you a copy." And I showed it to them, and they're like, "Oh, this is great." And they said, "You know what? We should back you." And I'm like, "So, like, you're going to do, like, a jazz trio thing?" And they're like, "Well, it won't be a jazz trio, but, you know what we do." And I said, "Yeah, I could read in front of that." And so we're going to put something together, I think.
They're a really sweet pair, those two.
Yeah.
They really are.
Yeah, I love them. In fact, I just listened to their CD on the way over here.
Yeah, they're super talented. And
super crazy.
Yeah. And they... the band I used to be in did some gigs with them back in the day in their old band when it was Threesome, I think.
Right,
it was.
Right.
Yeah, they're sweet folks. Yeah.
Yeah, so that'll be fun,
well, so
I hope.
When is that going to happen?
We're going to have to, like, get some dates organized and find some place to do it. So, I mean, you know, the Vientoliagua is an option. I think Portfolio would be an option, too. I just have to... to get my head straight. I've been sort of focused on this reading coming up next week, mm-hmm. So I really haven't done anything else in terms of, like, setting up gigs or whatever.
What do you have to do to prepare for the reading?
Nothing.
Just get your mind right?
Yeah, but it's like I've got so many other things going on. You know, like, I was going to call this book Finding My Way. And I went to bed one night about 2 months ago, and I'm laying in bed and I'm thinking, finding my way. It's just not working. I need. And then all of a sudden, Fire and Rain popped into my head, and I'm like, so I got up, totally reformatted the manuscript to accommodate Fire and Rain, and somebody said, "Oh, it's about James Taylor," and I'm like, no, it's not. And then I realized that there was actually a book about James Taylor called Fire and Rain. But I think people will figure this one out. You know, it says selected poems.
So it's not about James Taylor?
It's not about James Taylor. Although I love James Taylor. You know, he's a great songwriter. A man who certainly has been through a lot. So, you know, I could relate to that. But no, it's not about James Taylor. Okay.
Well, would you mind reading something from
of course not. It's like asking a musician if they'd mind playing something. You know? What do you want?
Oh, pick a good one.
Pick a good one. That's the problem. They're all good. let's see here. I should have thought of this before I came over, so I could just pop right to it. Well, here's a short one.
Great.
And this is based on a real event. It's called Pinto. For 2 days, I have seen the same miniature pony tied to a pole beside the highway. I keep looking for the midget guitar-toting caballero to come out of the Taco Bell, all smiles, to ride off into the happy ending.
Nice.
Short, funny.
Nice.
About a poem about Charles Perrault.
All right.
Because I used to watch his show on Sunday mornings. It was
Was it On the Road?
It was the Sunday morning news with Charles Perrault. It was on Channel 2. And mm-hmm. It was just before he did the On the Road series or any of that stuff. It was just him doing what he does. You know, right. And it's just, I just love that man. So anyway, after he passed away, I wrote this poem called Traveling Man. He brought into focus the road, those byways and highways that link us together. He traversed the North American continent so often that he knew the best places to be in just the right season, at just the right moment, to see the best sunset or catch the first bird in flight or celebrate the wildflowers blooming for the first time ever. In chapter and verse, he brought the land and the people alive, and each Sunday he brought the world to us, the world and his America of roads and people and people with good hearts and good dreams for the future. He brought us tales of hardship and hard work, of the rewards of perseverance and that damnable Yankee ingenuity. He brought into our attention the nobility of the American ideal of freedom and truth through the eyes and words of American artists and writers, of factory workers and civil servants, of farmers and jazz pianists, of musicians and dancers. And most importantly, he reminded us of the glory of our oft-forgotten gift of life by bringing the land to us in all its stark, unadorned, and unenhanced beauty. Willie and Jack may have written about it, but he lived it on the road.
Beautiful.
I get goosebumps for
it. Yeah, it was. I can feel your love for him.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of weird. We're talking about 9/11. I often wonder what would his reaction have been.
Why is that?
Well, because, you know, he had this sort of view of the American ideal and a kind of an overview sense of what this country could be. And I think when he passed away, we lost one more person who was kind of could put things in perspective, you know?
Yeah.
And that was a seminal experience, 9/11.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the things that I really felt was missing. It was perspective.
Yeah.
You know, that...
Well, there was all that knee-jerk reactionary crap. You know, just, oh, yeah, let's go get some ragheads, you know. Oh, yeah, let's... you know, I mean, all it brought out the worst in a lot of people, and I guess it brought out the best in a few people, but mostly that kind of got glossed over.
Yeah, the sort of national response to the event made me really sad.
Yeah,
maybe even more sad than the event itself.
Right. Know? Right. Yeah. Who knows what Bush would have done had that not happened? You know, he probably wouldn't have been reelected because he was all about, oh well, let's just let's ignore the world, let's just do our thing and keep our heads down, and you know. We don't want to get involved with all this crap in the world and blah, 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 blah. And as soon as 9/11 happened, well, you know, Dick Cheney and friends started rattling their sabers and, you know, and Georgie got a chance to fly, land on an aircraft carrier in a jet. Ooh.
Well, prior to 9/11, he spent a lot of time in Crawford, which I thought was good. You know, I thought
that
was a good thing.
Yeah, he should have stayed in Crawford.
but, yeah.
Such is life.
Well, so after this reading, any other plans or
I have another reading in June, the 1st of June, again fortuitously set up before the book came out at Beyond Baroque in Venice.
Oh, very cool.
So that'll be interesting.
Do you know the date?
June 1st.
Oh, excellent.
It's a Sunday, I believe. And beyond that, I don't have anything set up. I've been trying to, but again, it's like I have a better following outside of LA. I don't really understand how that works, but such is life.
It happens a lot. It happens a lot.
I guess. I know a lot of people. Well, like I went to the vaunted Long Beach Poetry Festival Wednesday night at Viento y Agua and heard Michael C. Ford and Laurel Ann Bogan, too. Fairly well-known Los Angeles poets. I actually interviewed Laurel Ann for my magazine back in 97, I think. And I'd known Michael C. for quite a while. And, you know, they pretty much can write their own ticket. They're pretty much established. I don't think I've got another 20 years in me to establish myself as a, you know, a famous Los Angeles poet. So, but, and they were good. They were okay. I mean, you know, I've heard them do better, but you know, it was a small room and, you know.
Was there a turnout?
Not really. There wasn't even any kind of indication on the door that there was going to be this a special event as part of the, you know, it's like the most under-promoted festival I've ever seen, you know.
Did you happen to participate at all in, there was a spoken word event a little while back that was sort of coordinated by the Arts Council for Long Beach?
I didn't hear about that. That's the thing. You don't hear about these things. I only knew about this because I got an email from G. Murray Thomas, who runs the Barnes & Noble reading on Tuesdays. And he said, oh, we're the Long Beach Poetry Festival is happening, and there's going to be a special reading tonight at Barnes & Noble. I'll be hosting it. Otherwise, I would never have known it was going on. You know, there's nothing in the paper. There's nothing in the... the district didn't even have anything. It's just like, oh, well, yeah. Oh, by the way.
Well, maybe this is an opportunity for the community to step up and help spread the word for the next one.
Yeah. Well, maybe if they included the community in that would help, you know. I mean, who wants to promote something that you're not involved with?
Well, that's true. But, I mean, there is a certain... there is a certain benefit in raising the idea that Long Beach is a home for poetry.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that there is a certain inherent value in that.
Well, it's funny. You know, a few years ago, man, you couldn't throw a rock in any direction and not hit a poetry reading, you know?
Yeah.
There was one every day of the week, everywhere, all over Los Angeles, all over Orange County, all over Long Beach. Even San Pedro had a reading. And now you're... really hard pressed to find anything that isn't happening below the Santa Monica Freeway. I mean, it's all up in like in Hollywood, and the Hollywood readings are, you know, they're full of actors, and you know, it's like they're doing their monologues or something. They're not really reading poetry that they've written.
Mm-hmm. Open started doing an event.
Yeah,
Other people's poetry,
right,
which I thought was a clever idea. But I think it was in response to this idea that somehow having an open mic for poetry is somehow no longer cool.
No, it's just, I think people are, of course, you know, me, Mr. Opinionated person that I am, you know, I think that the poetry has gone through a transformation and the level of quality has gone really down. So, you know, you got people doing stuff that they write. I mean, I used to run a reading in San Pedro, and I would see these guys sit in the back, and they'd write their little poem on the back of a flyer, and then they'd get up, and they'd read it. And, you know, it was just written, and for the most part, it was not very good. And that was kind of the mentality. And a thing that I discovered as a publisher, I mean, I had a magazine and I would publish people's poetry if they would send it to me, or even publish the Little Red Book series. I would publish a book of poetry if you would send me the poems. And I just never could get anybody from LA or Orange County to submit work to me. I mean, it was like pulling teeth, and I'm thinking, you're getting an opportunity to reach a broader audience, and you don't want that? Why are you doing this? And then I realized it's just for the plain old-fashioned ego rush that you get standing up in front of a microphone in front of a small crowd of your friends and reading something and having them all go, yeah, you're great, man. And, you know, and that's all they wanted, and that's all they needed. And I was like, oh, man, I need more than that.
Right.
You know, I want to reach a bigger audience.
Right.
And through the internet, I've managed to reach a bigger audience. You know, there's a guy in France that's got a really nice layout I sent him like one poem. A friend of mine said, hey, send this guy some work. He likes jazz poetry. So I sent him a couple of jazz poems. And he turned it into a big web page with he went to my website and pulled, you know, farmed a bunch of stuff out of there and put it on their web page that he made and has all these links. And, you know, he loves the book Fire and Rain. He's got a big page on that, and he's just going crazy. And I said, what do I owe you for this? And he's like, no, I'm not doing this for money. I'm doing this to promote good work. And I'm like, right on, man. You're my friend.
Yeah, there are people out there that are doing that.
And yeah.
I think that, you know, it's the same way with music too. I think that there are so many great bands that simply don't ever find their way to major labels, and
right.
so they've sort of even abandoned that as a notion now. And
well, again, it's that DIY, do it yourself. I mean,
right.
you get more respect from your you know, what do they call it, the long tail. Have you heard about that?
No.
It's a business plan that a friend of mine just turned me on to. She's got a band. Her and her husband have a band called Love Spirals, and they've put out like 3 CDs, and it's kind of spacey stuff. You know, it's kind of, with a name like Love Spirals, you know, you can't expect that. And yet they've got 1,000 fans who buy their product on a regular basis. And this business plan, it's called the long tail, because basically the model is you start out with your initial splash of, oh, hey, check this out. The new band is in town. And that's your initial, that's your startup point. But then after a while, it starts to decay. You know, the curve goes down, but it never like just stops. It goes down, down, down. And then there's this long period of where, you know, that's the long tail.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you start out with a really big, you know, boffo beginning. Wow. Yeah. But then you maintain a relationship with your fan base so that even though you're not like the new kid on the block anymore, they know who you are, and you keep in contact with them for the long tail, because that's where the money is. And they actually make a living from doing this.
That's great.
And she's like an internet personality. I had no idea. You know, she's on GoDaddy or something, and she said she did a show last week. She had the first day she had 10,000 hits.
Wow.
I mean, I'm lucky if I have 10,000 hits a year on my website, you know.
Wow, that's great. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to share with us?
Well, there's, you know, that poem I was talking about. I found it.
Oh, sure.
Can I read it?
Yeah, please.
Because it's kind of like my how I feel about poetry and what it does for me.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
And it is kind of an homage to Charles Bukowski as well. So, you know.
Okay.
It's called "The Poem Will Save You," and it begins with a quote by Bukowski where he says, "Even their nightmares are ringed with tinsel." Talking about the, you know, the middle class or something. I don't know what he's talking about, but he's, you know, people who obviously haven't experienced a great deal of heartache in their lifetime. It's the middle of May, and a warm tropical rain is falling, turning dusty streets into greasy ones. I'm reading the newest book of poesy from my favorite now dead poet, and marveling at his clarity and the strength of his lines. He said it, "The poem will save your ass from madness. The poem will save you while fat drops of acid rain descend, while the bills pile up, while the paint peels, while you wait and wait and wait for something to change. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's something. The poem will save you while your auto insurance climbs, while the phone screams your name, while the pipe calls to you from the other room, while your heart considers the pros and cons of early retirement, while the babies scream for attention, while your mind begins to go, while the dogs freak out in the living room, while lovers dream of each other, while you dream of becoming someone else, while hookers hook and junkies junk and the stoner gets steadily dimmer, while the whole country flatlines from a bad batch of crystal, while the beer goes flat, while the women come and go, while you jerk into the hollow memories of their brief laughter, while someone lets the air out of your tires and the wind out of your sails and the joy out of your days, while the life seeps out of your windows, each breath takes you further away from life and closer to death's final orbit, while the warranty on your VCR runs out, while the internet sucks you dry, while the open grave waits patiently, and the orange waits to be peeled, and the lights flicker, and the ground moves, and the really important stories wait to be sold, and the needle crawls across the floor at 3 a.m. like an inchworm, while you wait for its promise of happy stupidity, while you binge on lollipop dreams of power and glory, while they plot the next turn in your life, while the streets are overrun with anger and revenge, while you grab as much of the pie as you can carry, while the 911 call goes unanswered, while the oven begins to look very inviting, and you place a razor blade on your tongue and swallow, while you eat all the right food groups and still get cancer, while you starve to death on a diet of empty promises, stillborn dreams, and low-fat hopes, the poem will save you.
Thank you.
There you go.